2 weeks ago, I made a podcast about Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, or the GDPR. And that episode was one of the rare cases where I was dealing with GDPR issues, both in my personal life, thanks to this podcast and blog, and there was also some GDPR issues at my actual day job. So that episode had this beautiful synergy where it added value in my personal and professional life. I was really proud of that episode, and I found out that a few people at work actually used it in some presentations that they were doing, which made me super happy. But I thought I was going to be done with GDPR for at least a couple of months. But the minute I hit the publish button, there was an article from The Verge that basically said that 60% of US companies were not ready for GDPR. And I was like, ooh, that would have been perfect to add to this podcast. But I refrained for a couple of weeks. But since the GDPR went live on May 25th, there have been some very interesting things that have occurred. In fact, I think so many things have occurred since May 25th that a revisitation is already warranted. So this week, GDPR Part 2. I'm Joey Lombardi, and this is Sourcecast Episode 122. So let's jump right into the Verge article written by Sarah Jung, and its title is No One's Ready for the GDPR. And here's a direct quote from the article by Jason Strait, an attorney and chief privacy officer at United Lex, which is a company that sets up GDPR compliance programs for businesses. So here's the quote. Companies, especially US companies, are definitely scrambling here in the last month to get themselves ready. The article goes on to say, in a survey of over 1,000 companies conducted by the Ponemon Institute in April, half of the companies said they won't be compliant by the May 25th deadline. When broken down by industry, 60% of tech companies said they were not ready. The article goes on to say that basically this was an inevitable outcome. A year ago, 61% of companies had not even started GDPR implementation. In another quote from Jason Strait, he said that on the whole, European companies, especially those in countries like Germany and the UK, where there are pre-existing privacy laws that overlap GDPR, those countries have had a better time adjusting. But a survey in January of 2018 found that a quarter of London businesses didn't even know what GDPR was. And I mentioned in Sourcecast episode 119 that ignorance of the GDPR can be extremely dangerous because the GDPR can allow regulators to fine companies up to 4% of their global revenue for violations of the regulation. The Verge article uses Amazon as an example, and a 4% fine on Amazon would be $7 billion. And they also add this interesting tidbit that since Amazon reports huge revenues but relatively small profits, a 4% fine could cost them over 2 years of profit. I don't mean to keep bringing up Sourcecast episode 119, but I did get a little aggressive towards the end of the episode when I called out that the GDPR could be used as a weapon to silence bloggers and news organizations, basically smaller companies that don't have the resources to fight or even prove that they are complying with these rules. And interestingly enough, The Verge article quotes Peter Thiel, who accused Europe of enacting a protectionist legal regime. And I quote, "There are no successful tech companies in Europe, and they are jealous of the US, so they are punishing us." Thiel made that quote at an Economic Club of New York talk back in March. So while I don't necessarily always agree with Peter Thiel, it feels nice not to feel like the guy with the tinfoil hat on his head, but I'm not sure if I'm in good company. Tech Republic also covered this particular topic in an article by Connor Forrest, and the main gist of that article is saying, companies aren't really resisting GDPR, they just don't have their acts together. And I quote, "Despite the fast approaching deadline, only 36% of company leaders believe that they are fully compliant by the May 25th deadline. But that doesn't mean that these organizations aren't embracing GDPR. They are just not able to do it quickly enough. And some are looking to the coming regulation as a catalyst for cleaning house. 60% said that they are using it as a jumping off point for improved privacy, security, and data management, or as a means of creating a new business model." The Tech Republic article goes on to say that most companies are responding to GDPR by cutting the amount of personal data they store and limiting the number of employees with access to the personal data. 70% of the companies surveyed said that they are getting rid of unneeded data. So So while most tech companies have been actively preparing to some degree, by the time May 25th rolled around, some of the major tech companies immediately had complaints levied against them. CNET reported that Google, Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp have been hit with privacy complaints within hours of GDPR taking effect, complaints that could carry fines of $9.3 billion. A privacy advocacy group named Noib.eu, N-O-Y-B.eu, said that these four companies are forcing people to adopt a take-it-or-leave-it approach with regards to privacy, and they are essentially demanding that users submit to intrusive terms of service. This advocacy group, which again is spelled N-O-Y-B, Noib, is asking regulators in France, Belgium, Hamburg, and Australia to fine the four companies up to the maximum 4% of their annual revenue. But this would only occur if European regulators agree with NOYB.eu and decide to fine the companies the full amount. But I want to step back and call something out that's interesting. GDPR affects Europe, and US companies are only subject to fines if they are violating the rights of Europeans. If you're running a website and you have analytics or whatever data collection system you have turned on, you may not know that a European hit your site and information was gathered about them, which is why these rules sort of have to be turned on universally. But I'm sure technology will get around that. But the point that I'm making is, this NOYB group, they're Australian-based. So why is an Australian company going to the EU and has an EU domain when they're based in Australia? That seems a little bit fishy to me. I have no proof, but it would not surprise me if one of the major competitors of Google or Facebook had something to do with this customer privacy rights organization based in Australia. Even though this Australian group started digging at Google and Amazon, Google is emerging as an early winner of the GDPR. The Wall Street Journal published an article written by Nick Kostov and Sam Schechner. This article details how Google's advanced preparations have put them in at least a short-term competitive advantage against their competitors in the advertising space. So how did this occur? Google has built a system to gather individuals' consent for targeted advertising at far higher rates than many of the competing online ad services. So at the moment, the GDPR is actually reinforcing the strengths of the biggest online ad players, which is led by Google and Facebook. Here's a quote from the article that explains it. Hundreds of companies along the chain of automated bidding and selling of digital ads, from ad buyers to websites that show ads, have been scrambling to comply with the laws while continuing to target people based on personal information such as web browsing histories, offline purchases, and demographic details. Since Google became aware of the GDPR, they have been applying a relatively strict interpretation of how and where the new law requires consent, both on its own platforms and those of other firms. These stringent interpretations have helped Google avoid the GDPR's harshest penalties and has pushed the company to buy more ad inventory from its own exchange. Is this competitive advantage going to last? Probably not. But for the short term, Google is seeing a spike in ad revenue sales. In Sourcecast episode 119, I tried to lay out what GDPR was and then show how it affects smaller companies or people without resources. In many cases, when a country implements a ruling or a regulation, especially when it impacts privacy, there's a lot of gray area. And actually, when I found another great example of how this can be confusing to normal everyday people. As I progress in my podcast development skills, another thing that I've been looking into is video and photography, mostly video. So I found an article in one of the video blogs that I read that asked the question, how bad is GDPR for photographers? And it's an article by Hendrik Wiedewil for the website petapixel.com. So how does GDPR impact photography or video? I'm going to quote a lot here. I don't want to mince words. So I quote, if you're a professional, then you will need to fix your customer relationship management, your website, your data security, and much more. Just don't email those stupid GDPR emails if you run a newsletter. Chances are you'll make things worse. If in doubt, ask a lawyer, and there will be doubts. If you're just a mom and pop shop shooting pictures of your family, you should be fine. The GDPR does not apply to data processing in the course of a purely personal or household activity. But beware. If you have a million Instagram followers, your kid's birthday party is probably not a household activity anymore. If you are a photo enthusiast, then things get tricky. The GDPR sees photography as something even the first Terminator could do, processing personal data. And again, I'm still quoting here. Yes, your dreamy picture of that girl in the sunflower field is the collection and sharing of personal data in the eyes of a data protection officer. Many things in that photo are personal data. Her face, the location, the date, the time, and everything that is tied to her identity. The legal consequence is you need to provide some kind of justification to take that picture and to put it on your hard disk or to share it on Instagram. If you're a pro, you have a model release. If you're just a friend, it's out of the scope of the GDPR. Again, personal or household activity. But an enthusiast sits uncomfortably in the middle. This article goes on to say that things like street photography can be immensely problematic because in most cases, you can't get consent before you take the shot because it quote-unquote ruins the moment. But according to the GDPR, you cannot ask for consent after you take the picture. So this can get really interesting. I'm going to use a personal example. I've mentioned on this podcast before that I've gone to several SAP events for a variety of reasons, both professionally and personally. And I've noticed at these SAP events specifically that there are always a ton of camera people around. There are cameras everywhere at these SAP events. I'll admit that I don't love being on camera, but I'm not that shy. But I do recall at one specific SAP event, I was a little bit put off by the sheer amount of filming that was taking place. So this is a really interesting situation for companies that run conferences and record events. Even if they have some blanket permission to have the audience filmed, I suspect if the event is in Europe or has Europeans in attendance, the GDPR could override whatever disclaimer or authorization that comes with the ticket. With any widespread regulation, there are going to be problems in gray areas, like I mentioned before. As an American, I think I'm feeling a little bit more sensitive to the GDPR because I don't think it was public news until about 2 months ago. It wasn't part of the US news cycle. On paper, I do agree with a lot of the things that the GDPR is trying to do, but I'm going to repeat myself from Sourcecast episode 119. I do think that the GDPR can be used to inappropriately silence less powerful and smaller voices. I also think that it will be used as a tool for corporate backstabbing. I have no doubts that the GDPR will be weaponized, and we'll be seeing it, if we haven't already seen it, happen very soon. I hope you're enjoying my coverage of the GDPR, because I have a sneaking suspicion that there is going to be an episode number 3 relatively soon. Thanks for listening.
And that's all we have for this week. You can find Sourcecast on iTunes, Google Music, and all of your favorite podcasting applications. Sourcecast is recorded in bucolic Mandarin, New Jersey, and it's produced by my dad. The outro is performed by me, Ben Lombardi, and music is provided by Patrick Lee. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.